from Izmir, Turkey, I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. University of Oklahoma economist Ferhat Demir joins me again to talk about this week's bombing and protests in Ankara and its impact on life in Turkey.
I would not be surprised if ISIS is behind the scene, at least on the surface. We have to remember that the current government and the president refused to label ISIS as a terrorist organization.
Then I'll explore some of the parallels between Brazil's military dictatorships and the country's LGBTQ subculture in the 20th century with historian Jem Green.
Through other parts of the world, there is the emergence of new groups asking for equal rights for gays and lesbians. In Brazil, they're facing the worst years of repression.
We'll also discuss evolving U.S. opposition to Brazil's military junta in the 1960s and 70s. All that after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. I'm still here with Ferhat Demir. We are in Izmir, Turkey this week. And when we arrived on Saturday, we learned that there had been a bombing in Ankara, killing more than 100 people, injuring more than 200. Ferhat, we've seen quite a lot of reaction to this event. This isn't the first bombing. We've had several others here in Turkey in recent months. But give us some sense of what is going on here and what kind of relationship this has to the upcoming political elections in Turkey.
We have had two bombings in June, right before the election in Diyarbakir, and then there was another bombing in July that killed 34 high school and college kids that were coming together to bring humanitarian aid to the Kurds in Kobani. And in neither case, those who were responsible were arrested. And right after the election on June 7th, when the current government lost the supermajority, suddenly the war with the Kurds, the civil war, restarted. And many on the Kurdish party side and activists blame the current government for using the fight with the Kurds as an excuse to either postpone the elections or put a curfew on Kurdish cities so that they would gain against supermajority. There's a 10% threshold law in Turkey. So in the general election, if a party does not win 10% of the votes, their votes go and get distributed to other parties automatically. So in the last election, when the Kurdish party entered the parliament, AKP, the current government, lost their supermajority and they could not change the constitution to move the country into a presidential system without any checks and balances. In a sense, Mr. Erdogan would become the Mr. Putin of Turkey. And those plans failed when they lost the supermajority. And since then, we are seeing more than 500 people got killed in clashes between Kurdish guerrillas and the security forces. And there's an intensified battle, and the country is very under stress. People are very worried. Many people were scared that something like this would happen, just it was a matter of time. So this rally was organized by several labor unions, public sector unions, the Chambers of Commerce and Industry, the Architects Union, and the Kurdish party, HDP. The rally was to protest against war, and it was a peace rally. The idea was to pressure the government and the Kurdish guerrillas into stopping the warfare and reach a resolution. And this is when it happened, that they were gathering for the rally in front of the train station. And right when they were dancing, actually, when the college kids, young, the children, the elderly, when they were dancing, the bombs blew off.
So, Ferhat, like you said, this was a peace rally. And from what we've been told, although there's a ban on press coverage of this event here, Turkey is experiencing 3 days of mourning. The government did declare that. But what we've been told, or what we're hearing, is that these were two suicide bombers. But there's also some speculation that this could be, or at least this is what the government is saying, from what we can hear, is that ISIS is behind this bombing. I mean, is there any truth to that? And why would that be the case?
I would not be surprised if ISIS is behind the scene, at least on the surface. We have to remember that the current government and the president refused to label ISIS as a terrorist organization. And instead, they were very tolerant, calling that was a just reaction because of the anger by the Middle Eastern countries in Syria and Iraq against the foreign occupations. They did not label them as terrorists. ISIS has even a magazine published in Istanbul, is publicly available and still not banned. And the last two bombings were ISIS-related, and the government did not take any direct action. And we need to remember that the current government Just a few days before this bombing, there was a major rally organized by an organized crime leader who was arrested before many times. And he himself said during the rally to support the current government, he said the blood will flow like rivers. And this just happened a few days after that.
Well, this is, as far as we know, the worst single bombing in Turkey, in modern day Turkey. We've obviously seen a lot of tension and a lot of protests that have been breaking out around the country, even here in Izmir. So the question is, you know, are they going to be able to pull themselves together? Are we just going to see more of this happening as elections are only just a few days away?
The only good news out of this is that the opposition are getting together and there's a solidarity between among different factions of the society, both the Kemalists and the Kurds and the liberals and the left. They are united in their anger against the current government. In a press conference, the Minister of Interior was smiling, almost laughing, when he was asked if he's considering resigning from his post, and said there was no security breach and they did everything they could. So perhaps after the election, if we see a different view, different scenery regarding the election results, it might be different.
All right. Thank you so much, Ferhat, for being here with me in Turkey and for giving us your analysis of the situation. Thank you.
Thank you.
You can see several photos I took of protests in Izmir on our website, kgou.org. We've also shared them on Twitter, at WorldviewsKGOU and at KGOU News. You can get in touch with me directly, at Suzak Rolat. Next, we'll shift gears and talk about Brazil's relationship with the United States throughout the 20th century with Brown University historian Jem Green. We'll also take a look at the South American country's gay, lesbian, and transgender rights movement during that same period. I'm Suzak Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzak Rolat. My guest this half hour is Jem Green from Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. He studied and taught Latin American history for the past two decades. He's also the author of the books We Cannot Remain Silent, Opposition to the Brazilian Military Dictatorship in the United States, and Beyond Carnival, Male Homosexuality in 20th Century Brazil, which started out as his PhD dissertation at UCLA. Jem Green, welcome to Worldviews.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, Jem, you've written a book about Brazilian military dictatorship. For those of us who don't know a lot about Brazil and its history, as a historian, can you just give us kind of the 90-second version of history in Brazil regarding its military dictatorship?
Sure. So in the early 60s, the Cuban Revolution happened, and U.S. policymakers were very fearful that there would be other revolutions around the continent of Latin America. And so they saw a kind of a left liberal government in power as possibly turning into a revolutionary movement and supported people in that country in overthrowing the democratically elected government of a president named João Goulart and installing a 1964 dictatorship that lasted for 21 years. Brazil next year will be celebrating 30 years of democracy. So after 21 years of authoritarian rule, which included torture of oppositionists and political exile of opponents, the country is going through a process of consolidation of democracy. And part of that consolidation comes from the fact that during the second half of the 21 years of the military being in power, new social movements emerged to challenge the rule of the military. And from that began pushing for a more democratic country. And so Brazil experiences an unusual phenomenon of having very vibrant social movements today that are fighting for human rights, for equal rights, against state violence, against poor people, and has elected a series of people who were former guerrilla fighters. The current president, Dilma Rousseff, was actually involved in guerrilla activities against the military regime, or union leaders such as Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who was the president before Dilma, or Fernandinho Cardoso, who was an academic who lost his right to teach at the university because of the military regime. So today, the country is living with leaders who suffered under and fought against the military regime 30 years ago.
Well, you mentioned the activists and the social movements in Brazil, the very vibrant organizations that have helped fight this over the years and how they still exist today. And I want to get back to that on some specific issues in Brazil that are relevant then and now. But your book also touches on U.S. grassroots movements and how activists in the United States actually played a significant role in bringing down military dictatorship in Brazil. So can you tell us about how that happened and the impact or implications of that for U.S. foreign policy, particularly elsewhere in Latin America?
So In 1964, when the military came to power, the United States, under the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, supported the new dictatorship. And in Congress, people went along with the argument that this was a dangerous regime that had been overthrown in order to restore democracy. But by 1968, 69, it was clear that the military was not going to leave power. And in fact, they were deepening their authoritarian rule. And so one of the main problems that was going on in Brazil was that opponents of the regime were being arrested and tortured, brutally tortured. And so some of these political prisoners and others sent denunciations abroad. Some of those denunciations went to the National Council of Churches in New York. Others went to human rights groups in Europe, such as Amnesty International. And a small group of clerics, academics, a few Brazilians who were living in the United States and others decided they needed to respond to this situation. This was really the first systematic denunciation of torture being carried out by authoritarian regimes in Latin America. And so they started a campaign to educate the public about U.S. support for the military and also the need to end the torture of political prisoners. And this campaign managed to change public opinion in the United States, first by influencing newspapers such as Washington Post and the New York Times that started writing editorials criticizing the U.S. government support of the Brazilian regime, and later changing public opinion more broadly by rebranding Brazil not as a country of tropical delights and carnival and bossa nova, but as a country that violated the human rights of its citizens. And the campaigns that were developed in and around Brazil in the early 70s were then broadened after 1973 when there was a wave of authoritarian governments coming to power, first in Chile and Uruguay in 1973 and then in Argentina in 1976, where the repression was far out surpassed that of Brazil and in which the human rights violations were so shocking that major political figures in this country, Ted Kennedy and others, really were at the forefront of criticizing any U.S. support and supporting efforts to end these regimes.
So in terms of how the United States then changed its foreign policy in general, I mean, you make an argument in your book that these types of organizations actually changed and challenged U.S. foreign policy more generally. I mean, in terms of, as you mentioned, rebranding in Brazil, did this happen elsewhere as well?
So in 1976, Jimmy Carter, in the aftermath of the Watergate crisis and the disillusionment with the Nixon administration and the weakness of the Ford administration, runs on a campaign for changing foreign policy objectives of the United States around the world by using human rights as a yardstick for whether or not we would give economic, military, and political aid to countries. And he is elected and will really offer a new voice and a new vision for U.S. foreign policy that will inspire activists in Latin America in their own efforts to organize popular mobilizations against the military regimes. For once, Brazilian activists don't have an enemy in the White House, but someone who's really supporting their demands for human rights. And so Jimmy Carter and Rosalind Carter, who goes to Brazil and receives denunciations of human rights violations, really become international advocates for change in foreign policy. And this will inspire activists in other countries, such as Chile or Argentina, to realize that they can appeal internationally for support against their regimes in power and will kind of strengthen the willingness and the courage to fight against very, very brutal regimes that are, you know, squashing opposition in horrible ways.
That's Jim Green, a historian at Brown University who studies the U.S. relationship with Brazil's military dictatorship from the 1960s to the 1980s. More of our conversation right after a short break. I'm Suzette Guerlat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. My guest this half hour is Jim Green, a historian at Brown University who studies Brazilian history and culture. We've been talking about his book, We Cannot Remain Silent, Opposition to the Brazilian Military Dictatorship in the United States. So moving from that American context of, and looking at human rights issues, let's look at that human rights issue from the gay and lesbian right area in terms of what the history is there in Brazil of that type of activism and how much progress they've been able to make.
So in the United States, in the late 60s, there emerges a series of groups that or symbolized by what is called the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969, which kind of politicizes discrimination against gays and lesbians. And this phenomenon takes place not only in the United States, but also in Europe and in parts of Latin America. Argentina has a gay rights group that emerges in 1968, 69, and is trying to kind of question homophobia and discrimination in that country. Brazil has the potential for doing the same thing, but 68, 69 is the worst years of political repression, where it's impossible to organize, it's impossible to meet, there's censorship of the press, and fear that if you do something, you could really pay the consequences. So essentially, while through other parts of the world, there is the emergence of new groups asking for equal rights for gays and lesbians, in Brazil, they're facing the worst years of repression. So when an accumulation of forces in Brazil in the late 70s pushes for political opening and new social movements emerge. One of those social movements are gays and lesbians who are demanding an end to police violence and different treatment in the media and fuller rights. And the movement will start very slow and very small, but will by the 1980s grow and begin pushing for a change in age-old prejudices against gay men and lesbians and transsexual people. AIDS in the 1980s will be a setback in the sense this will cause a series of panics in the country. But the Brazilian government by the 90s, in part, in large part, because of these activists, will change its AIDS policy and become very, very progressive in offering free medication to anyone investing in AIDS treatment, and really insisting that people with HIV and AIDS have the same citizens' rights that anyone else does in the country. And then in the 90s into the 2000s, there will be a blossoming movement, which will today see the gay pride parade in São Paulo being the largest in the world with 3 million people in the streets every year demanding equal rights, pushing the government against discriminatory laws and politicians who still use this question as a wedge issue, either evangelical Christians or conservative Catholics who are still uncomfortable with equal rights for gays and lesbians. So the process of fighting against the dictatorship engendered other movements, especially the LGBTQ movement in Brazil, which are very vibrant and very forceful today, with many battles to win, but many successes along the way.
Well, so you mentioned the connection between the anti-dictatorship movements and how that influenced the gay and lesbian movement. But what about other movements in Brazil? I mean, it seems to be a very activist-oriented country, a very activist-oriented people. So other issues of prominence, the environment, others?
So there was in the same moment of kind of effervescence of political activism in the late 70s and the 80s, a new feminist movement that emerged that really questioned violence against women, demanded, for example, police stations where women could be attended by female officers to place domestic violence complaints, an environmental movement which really questioned the developmentalist policies of the state and questioned the uncontrolled industrialization of the country, land reform movements calling on the distribution of lands to subsistence farmers and small farmers so that they could continue to live on the land and produce food for the population. A strong movement of Afro-descendants questioning long-held rhetorical ideas that Brazil was a racial democracy by pointing out that the poorest are always black and they remain poor, and what are the forms of racism that keep Afro-descendants in the lowest rungs of Brazilian society. And this has led to new forms of affirmative action programs in universities to kind of increase the diversity at levels of higher education in the country. So many, many movements of slum dwellers for equal citizenship rights, against forcible removal. This is a question today because of the Olympics in Rio in 2016 that some parts of the city will be remodeled and people will be forcibly removed, and movements to protect people's rights to the residences that they have, as humbled as they may be. So Brazil has become a country of social movements and of activism and has had governments that have carried out social programs to try to address the long-term
inequalities that have been marked by Brazilian history since 1500.
So that being the case, then, let's bring this all back to this notion of democracy in Brazil. There seems to be a very solid civil society in Brazil, lots of social movements, as you're pointing out. So how would you say this is, how should we feel about democracy in Brazil today? Do you feel really confident, really optimistic? Is democracy strong and growing in Brazil today?
It's strong and it's growing, but the country is polarizing between a center-left and a center-right, and it's reflected in the recent elections where the current administration of Dilma Rousseff is under a series of attacks and criticisms, partially related to the fact that there's been a large-scale incidence of denunciation of corruption, especially in the petrochemical industry and the state-owned oil conglomerate called Petrobras. And so the arguments are that the president knew about this corruption and therefore should be impeached. There is a call for a mobilization to impeach the president. And this is really reflecting, in my mind, a deeper issue that the current administration and the previous one carried out a series of social programs which radically redistributed parts of wealth to poor people through a government aid program. And many people in the middle and upper classes feel very uncomfortable about this, in part because many people who used to have no other options other than to be maids or low-paid workers are looking for better jobs and are moving out of the sector. So the complaint is you can't get a good maid nowadays, or too many poor people are traveling on planes. It's really not like it used to be. They don't really know how to travel properly. And so there's a tension between the lower classes and people who support them and people who feel very uncomfortable about that. And that's being manifested in this political polarization that exists today. Nevertheless, I think that Brazil is a strong democracy. It's had three sets of presidents who were elected and left office. So the third one is currently in office. And I think that there will be a smooth transition in 2018 for another election. And democracy will be consolidated in the country. I'm very confident.
All right. Well, Jim, thank you so much for being here. Brazil is such a fascinating place, and you've really shed some light for us. And I appreciate you sharing your perspective.
It was a delight to be with you today. Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with historian Jim Green from Brown University in Rhode Island. You can find links and more information about the two books we've been talking about on our website, kgou.org. While you're there, you can also find links to our past episodes and subscribe to our weekly podcast. Worldviews is a collaborative production between KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Ivy Dyson prepares our content for the web, and the show is put together by Brian Hardzinski and Sam Dupre. For Farat Demir, I'm Suzette Gorlatt.